You're listening to Cosmic Perspective. Today our guests are Jeff Notkin and Steve Arnold. They travel all over this world looking for rocks from other worlds. Known to many as the Meteorite Men. Jeff and Steve, welcome.
Thank you. Hello, hello.
Great. We're in three different time zones, I guess, so we got it together here.
We're just so sophisticated. Just continent spanning.
You both have a pretty neat job. How do two people from very different backgrounds and different parts of the world get together and share their passion for finding rocks from other worlds?
It's all Steve's fault. I blame Steve for everything.
Is that right, Steve?
But it really is. It's all my fault. It's all my fault.
I'm glad you finally owned up to that.
Well, you know, someone's got to. No, I think it really started with Jeff because he's a little bit older than I am, and he got the inquisitive bug a little bit earlier than I did. But we were on two totally different paths. I mean, I don't think you could have scripted something more opposite in life stories that converged the way ours did. Hey Jeff, let's throw it out. I grew up in Kansas. You grew up,
in case you forgot, in the UK.
Yeah,
in London,
in
South
the UK.
London. Oh, we could do it back and forth. How different we are.
Is that So I grew up in Kansas, and you grew up in the UK.
That's
throw
true.
Out another one of us.
Well, as has been widely documented, I'm a rather enthusiastic vegetarian.
And I'm a quite enthusiastic meat-atarian.
Carnivore.
Yes, that too.
And Steve's a married man with a lovely wife and two lovely daughters, and I live on my own in the middle of the desert with an eccentric cat.
Oh,
and then we have kind of slightly differing political viewpoints, I'd say, would be...
Yes, this is true. Although I would point out, I think we're very, very tolerant of each other, in spite of things. I think because we know we would kill each other if we actually weren't. I grew up kind of, I guess, as a football star, and you grew up more a punk rock star. Totally different scene.
Yeah.
I can't even keep a beat with the tambourine. And how many instruments do you play?
Oh, just four or five.
Yeah. And can sing, which you don't even want to get me started there. Jeff's organized in a lot of ways, and some people would call me a little bit sloppy. However, I do appreciate, if anybody has watched the show, I appreciate methodical gridding, because I just don't like to go, you know, once an area is covered, I like to go, okay, I've covered that, let's move on. And Jeff kind of likes to meander around and feel where the meteorites might be. So that's just a few of the many. I don't know, there's probably 20 or 25 things we could list. If we had a five-hour show, we could go into that.
And yet, despite these seemingly earth-shaking differences, we've been friends for, what is it now, 15 years?
Yeah.
Longer, surely. Or does it just seem longer?
Yeah.
So when Steve said gridding, he's referring to a technique that we use in the field when we're at a site and we think that there are meteorites, or in some cases we know there are meteorites there. And gridding is a technique whereby you walk back and forth with your metal detector or with a vehicle towing a metal detector and methodically cover the entire area, which is the sensible way to do it. And as Steve points out, when you've done that, you know you've covered an area, and hopefully you find meteorites in the process. But I find it a bit tiresome, and I like to kind of walk around and go, I don't know, I think under that tree would be a really good place to look, which is about maybe 30% science and about 70%. It just seems like it would be fun to walk over there.
Intuition, maybe?
Yeah, intuition. That's a nice name for it. Randomness, one might say. And I'm not a cosmic type person in the sense that I think one might receive kind of a feeling, I don't know, it seems like, let me listen. Oh yes, my heart tells me the meteorites are over there. That doesn't really work, but I do it anyway. And then when I accidentally find one, I go, yay, see? I followed my intuition and it paid off.
My guess is that you're limited in the amount of time that you can stay in these places where you're hunting for meteorites. You must be fighting the clock from time to time.
Yes, very much so. And part of that is in often cases, it seems, especially where special permission is granted, that requires, you know, other personnel, whether it's park rangers or university personnel or someone that, you know, they have to take off from their work and come and escort us, or other things is just the practical side of production schedules. You know, we have only so much time to get all of our expeditions done and recorded so that, you know, the shows can be made. So oftentimes these things are scheduled ahead of time, you know, and we have airplane tickets and whatnot. So if they give us 4 days or 5 days at a location, that's all we've got. And, you know, we've got to make do with what we have there.
This is Andy Panaros. You're listening to The Cosmic Perspective. Our guests today are meteorite hunters Jeff Notkin and Steve Arnold. We're talking about their great stories and really cool experiences hunting for meteorites. Jeff and Steve, when you're on these meteorite hunts, you must have all kinds of obstacles, weather, snakes, all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, there are plenty of obstacles. And you mentioned weather, and I think the best example of us battling the weather was when we were filming in Australia for the second season, and we went to the Henbury Craters in the Northern Territories in the Australian outback. And Henbury is one of the must-see sites in the world if you're a meteorite enthusiast or professional. There are 15 craters in very close proximity, and some of them are quite large. And there are four craters that are on top of each other. They're shoulder to shoulder, and they actually share a common wall in the middle. So this tells us that the meteorites that formed those craters hit the Earth after an almost perpendicular journey through the atmosphere, perpendicular sort of wow. angle of the surface, I should say. So we were very excited to go there. And it's a national preserve. You can't just show up and start looking for meteorites. The craters are protected, and rightly so, because they're a very important landmark and scientific feature. We were granted remarkable permission from the Australian Park Service to hunt for meteorites there for a few days. They were extremely gracious to us. So I could not possibly have been more excited. It was probably the number one location in the world that I wanted to go to. I've been fascinated by the site since I was a kid. And we get there, and it starts raining. And the locals were very happy about it because they don't get much rain out there. And it was the heaviest rain they'd had in 35 years, the 1 week that we were filming. We went through extraordinary drives. There's a dirt road that I guess is about 10 or 12 miles from the highway to the craters. And that just turned into a mud bath. And it was the only time I remember in all of our filming and all of our travel that the director stopped shooting for one day. We got up in the morning, and it was just pouring with rain. It was gray, and there was very little light, and it was misty and windy, and he said, "We're just not filming today." I'd never seen that happen before. Doesn't matter how bad the weather is or how tired everyone is or how many flat tires we get or other problems, the filming goes on. So Steve and I were quite excited, and we said, "Well, we're going to go down. We're going to go then, just the two of us, if you don't mind." And they don't really like us to go out on our own without supervision, like two naughty school children. And it's because we perhaps get a bit over-enthusiastic when we're looking for meteorites, and there is always the fear that we might do something a bit reckless. And, for example, drive on our own through a flooded river to get to the site, which is exactly what we did. And miraculously, they let us go that day. And it's not that they think we're naughty kids, it's that if anything happens to us, they can't finish the episode. So it is quite sensible to look out for us. But to our surprise, our supervising producer, who was in charge, said, okay, you guys go have fun. We'll see you tonight. So we got in the truck and we left. And we heard this story later. The director said to her, oh, those guys won't last half an hour. It's raining so hard, they're going to come back. They're going to come right back. And she looked at him and said, have you seen the show? Which I found very amusing. In other words, saying, the guys are crazy and it doesn't matter what the weather's like, they're going to go. And so it was a treat for us, because that one day we got to hunt in the craters without having to do any work. We didn't have the camera crew following us, and we didn't have to stop. And
untethered, as I like to say.
Tethered, yeah, that's a good word. So we sometimes are so excited about what we're doing that we kind of don't look at the big picture. And we drove down this flooded road, and we drove through this river on our own in our truck, and the water came up to the bottom of the doors. And it didn't occur to us that after spending the entire day hunting in the pouring rain, when we returned to the hotel, the rivers would then be more flooded. And the last flooded wash that we drove through, the water was up to the windows in the truck. It was that deep. And in Australia, if you rent an off-road vehicle, they typically have snorkels attached. And that is the exhaust pipe running up the side of the truck.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they waterproof the engines, because when it floods out there, it really floods. So you can almost drive your vehicle as if it were a submarine, and that is what we did. And I was driving, and Steve's a very good co-pilot, and we drove up to the edge of this. It wasn't a flooded wash anymore. It was actually a river, and it was the only way back to town. So we stopped, and we got out, and we had a look, and I waded in a little bit, and then it got too deep, and Steve said, I think you should just go for it. And so we backed the truck up. It was a classic moment. We backed it up and got some speed and hit the water really hard, and Steve's hanging on, and he goes, Jeff, whatever happens, don't take your foot off the gas, because if you lose your momentum, you're done. And we got to the deepest part, and the truck was struggling, and it was kind of sighing and coughing, and I thought we were going to lose it. I thought we were going to get washed down the river, but we just managed to pull out on the other side. If it had been another 6 inches, I think we'd still be there. We'd be in a watery grave somewhere in the Australian outback.
You're listening to the holiday edition of Cosmic Perspective. Our guests are Steve Notkin and Jeff Arnold, known as the Meteorite Men. Steve and Jeff, you've been all over the world. Western United States, Canada, Sweden, Russia, Chile. What was your most memorable experience?
What do you think, Steve?
Wow. I get that question asked all the time, and I really should probably just stick with one answer and come up with one really good one. But there really are so many. I usually just ask people to kind of qualify. What do you mean? Like the biggest I found, the most I found, the closest I came to dying, where I found something bigger and better than Jeff found, or it's so tough. It every once in a while, we just have to stop and go, wow. I remember Jeff was talking earlier about Australia, and it was really funny. I mean, our schedule was so tight on our trip to Australia. I tell people I got to see the opera house, from the plane, and that was it. I mean, we were in, and we went out to way out in the middle of nowhere, did our shooting, went back, got on a plane, and we would have loved to stay at either location for like 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, we could have spent 2 months there, and we weren't. But on our way going to the site for the Munger Bill episode, we're standing at this cliff edge where the convoy pulls off the road, and it was only like a mile off the highway. And then there's this, like, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000, 3 foot, 1,000 foot drop to the ocean, and you just go, that's the end of the world. It's like that. The next spot's Antarctica. And And, okay, you know, the cameras weren't rolling. We weren't finding meteorites. But for me, that was one of the most awe-inspiring things, was like, wow, here we are at the end of the world.
Just kind of have to pinch yourself, I guess, at some
point. Yeah, yeah. And then 3 minutes later, they go, okay, everybody, get back here. Let's go. We got a show to make. You know, and then we're off, you know, making the show. So, you know, there were... Gee whiz, eating putrefied fish and sweet, and not that that was enjoyable, but the fact that...
I did see that episode.
the fact that I didn't throw up is a major accomplishment for me.
I should jump in there, and it's interesting that you mentioned that stop in Australia, because that resonated with me as well, and it was one of those few moments when we had a moment to just look at the view and relax. And you took a great photo of me standing right at the spot you described at the edge of the cliffs, and it's on my Facebook page. That's my banner photo on my Facebook page, was taken, Steve took at that spot. And I've got my arms spread wide, and I've got this big smile on my face because it was so magnificent, this view. And it did seem like there was nothing else after that. And you can almost understand how ancient explorers thought if you sailed too far across the oceans, you would sail off the edge of the world. It did feel like that. But I think it is so difficult to pick one moment that was my favorite. But if I had to, I'd probably go with Monturaqui Crater in Chile. And Steve and I went to Chile together in 1997, and we had just met. It was many, many years before Meteorite Men, the TV show. And we went on this expedition, and the kind of guys we are is we wouldn't do something locally first to see how we got on. We decided to go to the Atacama Desert in Chile. And we hadn't met in person up until then. We'd corresponded by email and we'd spoken on the phone. But our first in-person meeting was in Chile. And then we got in the truck and we drove across the desert for 3 weeks. So it's lucky that we got along well, because it could have been a very unpleasant trip otherwise. And we visited several important meteorite sites on that expedition. And we tried to find this remarkable meteorite crater called Monturaqui that is about a 100,000-year-old impact feature in a very remote part of the northern Atacama Desert. And we just couldn't find it. And we spent days looking for it. And that was 1997, so we had GPS, but it was very primitive, and we did not yet have things like Google Earth that would perhaps have made it easier to find. It was frustrating because we had an old photograph taken at the crater. It was taken in the 1960s by a Scandinavian team that discovered it. And they're standing on the rim of the crater, and behind them is this very unusually shaped mountain. And we could see the mountain. We're driving around the mountain, and we knew that we were close, but we could not find a track up through the cliffs to get there. And listeners probably go, oh, well, why didn't you just walk? We're talking about enormous distances here, and the altitude was 9,000 or 10,000 feet. The air is quite thin. It's extremely dry. You have to carry a lot of water. It's quite hazardous to travel out there on your own. So it was an early and major disappointment for me in my career, because I'm fascinated by craters, and I really wanted to see this. So when we were doing season two of Meteorite Men, we pushed to go back to Chile. We had a great adventure there in the 90s, and since our first trip there, we had developed new skills, we had better equipment, we understood meteorites and strewn fields much better than we did when we were younger. So we wanted to take our new knowledge and our new tools and go to these sites that we were familiar with, and it's such a beautiful country, I really wanted to go back anyway. And it was right around the time of that terrible earthquake in Santiago. So our production team said, no, it's too dangerous. We can't go to Chile. The airports will be shut down and infrastructure is damaged. And we were having this conference call, and Steve, with his usual insight and humor, made a comment that everybody was able to relate to. And he said, listen, when there's an earthquake in Los Angeles, they don't close the airports in Ohio. Those are the distances we're talking about. So we flew to Antofagasta, which is in the north, and revisited sites that we had seen 13 years earlier. And we finally made it to Monturaqui Crater. And if you visit, for example, Odessa Crater here in the States, in Texas, that we were talking about earlier, or the famous Meteor Crater in Arizona, or the Henbury Craters in Australia, these are protected sites. And there are people in charge. You can't just drive into the crater or go and start looking for meteorites because they're protected sites. It's not the case in Chile with Monturaqui. That crater is in the middle of nowhere, up in a mountain range. Most people couldn't even get there. So there is no fence and there is no ticket booth or gift shop. It's just a magnificent crater in the middle of nowhere. So we camped on the floor of the crater. We actually took all our vehicles and drove down the crater wall and set up camp. And that, for me, was a magical experience, to actually spend the night in a giant 100,000-year-old meteorite crater. Yeah, that one's going to be tough to beat for me.
Yeah, and have that connection, the connection between...
Yeah, and you know, that is one of the big rewards on being able to sit at home, do research, and go, you know what, there should be a meteorite right there. You look at the strewn field where maybe in, you know, an old field where we know where other pieces have been found, and we know that the laws of physics, when a meteor comes in and a meteoroid comes in, it hits our atmosphere. Usually it does break up. The pieces are spread across in a fairly predictable pattern. So when you're able to find where some of the other ones have been found, you can guess at where maybe there should be something else, and you go, there should be something right there. And you go out there and you get the right equipment and you go out and you find that there's something really rewarding about that. And as Jeff pointed out, there's something really frustrating about it when you should be able to find a hole in the ground. You're not even looking for a meteorite. You're just looking for this huge hole in the ground, and you can't find it. And, you know, a little diversion on that, one thing that was incredibly rewarding for me with the show was the find that we had at San Juan, and we did two episodes. We actually did four different, really, expeditions in Chile, but they combined two for two different episodes, and the one in San Juan is the one find out of all of the episodes we've done where it really was a cold find. There was this zone where quite a few meteorites had been found, and it was a little bit of an enigma to us. It was like, wow, why have so many meteorites been found in this really like 1 square mile area? And so we thought, well, maybe there's something special about the area or whatever. So we showed up, and all the other places, it was like ahead of time, we would say, well, this is where we want to go, and this is the type of meteorite we're looking for, and this is what we think we should be able to find, and this is the science that would be behind it and stuff. And in this one particular case, We were, and this is really dangerous. And I tell people that one of the really tough things about our show is about every other show in the world, the executives want word for word the whole show scripted ahead of time. Even other, and I don't want to ruin this for all the people that are naive about this, but even other reality shows are oftentimes scripted.
Sure.
And these executives, they want like 150-page word for, and they go back and forth. No, don't say this. Have them say it this way. Cut that. And they wrestle back and forth, and then they finally settle in on what they want. And then the networks say, okay, here's the money. Go make us this show. Our production company would send the network like 4 pages. This is where the guys want to go. This is the equipment. This is what they're looking for. This is the science. This is who, you know, we'll have come and talk. Mm-hmm. This is equipment they'll use. we hope they find something. And drama is really wonderful on the TV screen. Drama in the TV executives' offices, not so good. And that puts a lot of pressure on us because they really want us to find stuff. And, you know, the San Juan expedition, which there's a little pressure, was off because it was like, okay, we knew we would find something at Imlek. We knew we'd find something at Monarchy if we could get there. And then we knew we could find, no, we actually didn't know we could find something at Vaca Muerta, but we knew that we would find something in both of those episodes, but we didn't know if we'd find something in all four locations, and that one was just poof. I mean, it could have just as easily been, if I was looking the other direction instead of the other way, I would have missed that rock. And so that one was I think, rewarding in a really special way because it was really almost felt like a gift, and it wasn't something that I could really get a lot of credit for because it was just sort of luck.
A small meteorite is sometimes like that one, is more memorable than probably the largest one you found.
Well, no. It's memorable in different reasons.
So a big meteorite's a big thing. What was the biggest find, biggest meteorite find?
On the pilot episode, when we were filming in Brenham, Kansas, the largest meteorite that we found during the show was actually during the pilot episode, which was a bit tough for us because we set the bar really high on the very first episode. And then our executive producer was always going, yeah, go find more big ones like that one from the pilot. And we were going, we could say, yeah, we want to also find big ones. It's just really hard because there aren't many of them in the world in total. So we were at this site known as Brenham, and it's in western Kansas. And this is a great example of us revisiting historic sites where meteorites were found in the past. And this was Steve's pet project, and he'd been interested in this site for many years and kept going back there and eventually met one of the landowners and developed this new meteorite hunting equipment and was very successful at the site. So when we started filming Meteorite Men, the idea was we would go to the site where we thought there might be more meteorites. The entire area had not been hunted. We had some untouched ground. So we took the big metal detector out that Steve designed, and we're driving around in this field with it. But you have to cover huge areas, hundreds and hundreds of acres. And A, you couldn't do it on foot. It would take you the rest of your life. And B, with a small handheld metal detector, you're never going to get the signal deep enough into the ground to find these large, deeply buried targets. So we're driving and driving, and we got this really strong signal, and it was all in real time. The cameras are following us, and we were very excited. This is a really good spot. This is in the Strin field. It's looking good. It sounds like a big, big target. And so we bring in the backhoe, and we start digging, and we get more and more excited, and the cameras are rolling, and then the bucket on the backhoe scrapes the metal, and we go, this is it. And then it pulls the thing out. And this classic moment where Steve goes, look at that. It's a 55-gallon oil drum with a 30-gallon oil drum inside it. How lucky can you get? And our director, who's a wonderful guy, he's very enthusiastic, Bob Melissa. We really liked working with him. He was laughing so hard. He had this big smile on his face. And he kind of came over to me and he slapped me on the back. And I was quite annoyed. I go, it's not funny, you know. We thought it was going to be a meteorite, and you're laughing. And he goes, no, sorry, Jeff. The look of disappointment on your face was so priceless. You never could have faked that. So it was a good example, a good learning experience for us right at the beginning, because we realized that our failures being televised can be very entertaining for other people, especially when I get annoyed. And Steve's very even-keeled, and he's a very good-natured guy and not much flustered them. But
I've known that for years, though, Jeff. I've been entertained with you being annoyed, you know, for a long
time.
Yeah,
I've noticed. So the longer the expedition goes and the longer we're not finding anything, the more annoyed I get. And the executives for the show found that to be very entertaining. They liked that.
I think there's one thing that what most of us don't think about, and especially people who haven't seen the show, is that you find, you call the media wrongs, and you find a lot more media wrongs than you find media rights.
Oh, yeah. And
yeah, oftentimes that is the case. And, you know, I think there's, early on, we were really, I don't want to say overly concerned, but primarily concerned with finding the media rights. And I think one of the things we began to appreciate, especially after the first season, is that the media wrongs do add an element of genuine drama and good opportunity for commercial breaks on, oh, did the guys find something, or what did they find? And, you know, to come back to, oh, it's just a horseshoe, or, you know, it's a piece of barbed wire. And that's okay. You know, it's real life. It's what we really run into on a regular basis, and it adds opportunity for humor. It adds opportunity for you know, the frustration to be transferred to the viewing audience, and I think it allows people to get a glimpse of what it's really like.
Reality.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, I've asked about the time limit that we have at sites, and certainly in numerous circumstances, there was a fixed limit because we needed to have someone there to monitor what we were doing, and it's expensive to have specialists out in the field with us, and scientists only have limited time to work with us and so forth. But, of course, there is always the pressure of getting on to make the next episode. And quite often we've been asked by people who've been watching the show and are very puzzled and say, but I don't understand, you're in Sweden, you've gone all the way north of the Arctic Circle to this amazing spot, and you're finding meteorites, why do you leave? And the truth is because we had to go make another episode in a different country. And Steve made the point earlier that those sites in Australia, and he's absolutely correct, we would love to have spent 2 or 3 weeks at each site. But you can't. We can't have the crew sitting around for days on end while we're doing what we do. So it was wonderful to get to these places, some of which were entirely new to us, and some of which we never would have been able to hunt at without the connections provided by the television series. So that was the good part, and then the bad part was it seems many times we were really getting into our groove and we were starting to find a lot of meteorites and a lot of good material, and then, oops, last day, get on the plane, go back to Scandinavia or go to Russia. So we learned to use every scrap of time to the best of our ability.
And then sometimes we would cheat because we started to learn that if we would find what our director thought was enough for a show, it would be, okay, that's a wrap, let's go, guys, and we would leave, and then we would go sit for hours and do interviews and stuff, and we would get frustrated. So there were times where, like for example, like at Imalac, where we found lots and lots of meteorites, but there was a lot of times we weren't finding a lot. And so sometimes we would stumble on an area and we'd start finding stuff, or sometimes they would take the crews off and they'd go get their shots of, you know, the sunset or the coyotes or, you know, or the whatever, a cloud going by, whatever. They call that B-roll. And they would let us just kind of go untethered and we could just go and that was always good to try to, like, get into a good sweet spot, and then we would you know, we'd say, hey, we're in a good spot. They bring the crew back, and then we'd pick up again. And then sometimes Jeff and I would go, okay, we're in a good spot, but let's not tell them we're in a good spot yet. Because we knew that if we found a good enough rock, they would go, okay, that's a wrap, let's go. And we wanted to keep hunting. So there were a couple times we would keep hunting, and we knew we were in a good spot, and we just found stuff that didn't get on tape, you know. we were being a little selfish that way, but
you're not supposed to tell that story. You're so naughty.
No, but you know, it's okay now. Confession's good for the soul, they say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you should try it
once more.
Experience
for you, I should think.
Yeah.
Well, you don't really have a whole lot to confess about. You're such a good lad.
Well,
at least you appear to be a good lad on television.
Yeah, I'm as Jessica Rabbit says, I'm drawn that way.
Oh, I got distracted again because I was actually telling the story about the biggest meteorite that we found on the show, which was at Brenham, Kansas, and it was after the incident with the 55-gallon oil drum. Andy asked about half an hour ago what was the largest meteorite that we found.
That's okay. We're all enjoying this. It's wonderful.
Oh, good. Thanks. Well, it was a 273-pound specimen of palestite that's half nickel iron and half olivine crystals. So that was the largest that we found on the show. But Steve's found considerably larger at that site when we weren't filming. And there was a very amusing incident during the pilot. And I mentioned this in my book. I tell the story in some detail. We were at another site in Kansas that we called the Alpha site because it was a secret location at the time. And again, we had limited shooting period. And so we found two significant meteorites on camera. And the second one was really at the end of the last day of filming, and the light was starting to fade, and it's all very dramatic, and we dug it up a little bit before it got dark, and that was exactly the way it happened. We didn't stage anything like that. There was a lot of natural drama while we were making the show. And then so we dug up these two meteorites, and the director's really happy, and then it's getting dark, and the crew starts packing up to go back to the hotel, and we said, hey, we've got another target in the ground. And the director goes, well, we're done. You know, it's dark, and the crew's done their 12-hour day, and we're leaving tomorrow. So we said, well, we're not leaving this target in the ground. We want to know what it is, and somebody else might come along if we don't dig it up. And he goes, well, you can stay, do whatever you want. So everyone went back to the hotel except for us and the landowner and a couple of friends of ours who were observing the shoes. And it was pitch black by then, so we got our three trucks and we drove them into the middle of this field and turned the headlights on and had all the headlights facing in this one spot where we had received this very strong target. And we dug it by hand in total darkness. And it was a 79-pound meteorite. So that would have been on the show if we'd had one more day of filming. But to me, the amusing part is periodically a car would drive by on the little country road beside the farm. And I wondered what they thought, because it's as dark as can be. There are no streetlights. There's no moon. It's dark, dark, dark. And here are three vehicles in the middle of a field with a group of people frantically digging in the middle of the night. And I thought, people driving by, there's only one explanation. They're definitely going to think we're burying a body out there. So fortunately, the police did not come. It must have been a weird sight. And we got some great photos. We pulled the piece out, and it was quite a deep hole. We pulled the piece out, and we're standing there in this hole that we've excavated, propping up this 79-pound meteorite. And again, this story is told in more detail in my book, and there's a very funny photo with the two of us. And we're a bit sunburned because we've been filming. It was the summer. We've been filming all day. And there's this big meteorite, and there's this hole. And the photograph's very obviously taken at night because there's a flash. And then I look at that photo and I think, what must people think of us? It looks very suspicious, as if we had sneaked in somewhere and we had dug up this meteorite at night because we weren't supposed to be there, which absolutely is not the case. But it sure looks that way. That was a favorite moment for me. That was so funny. And then we got back to the hotel, and it was very late by the time we got back. And the crew had their dinner, and they're chilling out. And we arrive, and we're covered in mud, and we're very excited. And the director goes, "How'd you do?" We go, "Oh, we found another one." He goes, "Really? You found another one in the dark?" So, but I found that one of the highlights of our careers, just because of its degree of wackiness, I think. Yes, we're so obsessed, we will dig in a field in the middle of the night in order to get the meteorite.
I mean, certainly if anybody's seen any of your shows, they know how passionate you are about this. And to go through all these countries, all these adventures, and still want to do more. And I'm sure that you have some plans to do other digs anywhere?
Oh, always. We're always investigating. And we have a number of pet projects. There are several sites we really, really wanted to go to on the show. And we would, each year, we'd get together with the producers. And Steve and I picked the locations for the most part. Sites that we thought would be visually interesting and sites where we thought there was a good chance of finding meteorites, because we're the only people who know. This is, producers on a normal television show could go, well, we want to do a scene in a restaurant, and then we want to do a scene in the cafe or the bank or whatever for a normal reality show, but you can't do that with our show. So we would each year present the producers with a list of locations, and we'd typically come up with 10 or 12 locations, and with a little breakdown about why each one's interesting and what our chances were, we thought, of finding something there. And there are a couple of stories in meteorite lore and legend that are fascinating. And there was one in particular about this meteorite that was found over about 100 years ago, and then it was lost. And it's a very, very valuable meteorite, and we have a pretty good idea of where it is. So every year we would pitch this story to the executives, and every year they'd go, well, what are your chances of finding it? And we go, well, pretty slim, but if we do find it, it's $500,000 meteorite. And we just could not sell this idea. So there are sites we have researched extensively that we still have not worked at to our satisfaction. So, yeah, there's always stuff percolating in the back of Steve's mind. He'll periodically call up and go, Jeff, did you ever hear the story about the so-and-so meteorite? And he's found a new lead or a paper that we've never come across before. And there's a tale about this farmer finding a meteorite in the 1800s, and then what happened to it, and then it shows up 50 years later at the Smithsonian. So there's a lot of detective work involved, and sometimes we'll be sitting around and we'll go, oh, what about such and such a site? We thought about that 10 years ago. We never went. Maybe we should go. So, yes, there are plenty more adventures to be had.
Any thoughts of going to Antarctica?
Oh, that's another one that we'd love to do. And that's another one that we pitched every year. And we'd say, and we really got on well with our producers, and they were very supportive of the show, and I think they appreciated our wacky sense of humor. So, but we joke around a bit and say, hey, you know, you said you wanted us to find a lot of meteorites, and there's one place in the world we can guarantee we will, and that's Antarctica. And it is, of course, hazardous and extremely expensive to go. And it was not, there was not sufficient budget for the show. And Steve said, well, why don't we do it as a two-parter or do it as a whole season? And season 4 of Meteorite Men in Antarctica. So I think viewers might have gotten a bit tired of 8 episodes in Antarctica, but we probably could have done it.
I could certainly see the cost of going there would be tremendous.
Oh, yeah. And it, of course, the American expeditions that go each year are funded by the National Science Foundation, and we would need to hire our own planes and our own snowmobiles and Antarctic survival experts and the rest of it. And I completely understand that it was not within the budget of the show to do such a thing, but that didn't stop us from bringing it up every year. We go, oh, Antarctic is still there. We could do a bit with giant penguins, and We try and make it very music and try and sell it every year, and it was always the same thing. No, we're not going to.
Yeah, they do like variety, different ways to hunt meteorites, different locations, different experts, different science, different as each episode could be, they wanted variety. And, yeah, I think Antarctica would be just too too much of the same old to be more than a couple episodes. And to get them back in 4 days or 5 days times two, not going to happen. So,
and I have several friends that have been to Antarctica on scientific expeditions, and there's this fairly dodgy travel segment that you have to do from Auckland in New Zealand, flying to McMurdo Station in Antarctica. And I have a friend who's experienced this repeatedly, that you fly in an Air Force transport plane, such as a Hercules, and there is a point after which there's not enough fuel to turn back. And the landing strip in Antarctica is frequently closed due to bad weather. So the plane leaves Auckland and it flies almost halfway to Antarctica, and then it has to turn back to New Zealand because it's not going to be able to land. And so this happens every day until they finally get there. And I thought, that's not going to go well with the producers if we mention, yeah, well, we could actually be stranded for a week and not even be able to get there. And that's your whole shooting schedule.
And then there is the little window of opportunity where there's only about 6 or 8 weeks out of the year where Antarctica is even survivable. And we seem to have hit our production schedules in the summertime in North America, which is not always the best time to be in Antarctica. So multiple reasons on why that hasn't and probably will never work out. But nonetheless, it still would be the great happy hunting grounds if there's ever a way to do it. So,
well, you never know. You never know.
You never know. Maybe one day down the road it could be a special that we go and do a 2-hour special or something. That would be fun. We should pitch that, Jeff.
I'm ready.
All right.
I've got my Arctic gear always ready to go.
Would you take me with you?
Definitely.
I tell my family, I tell my family that I'd like to go, you know, with this National Science Foundation thing you're talking about. And of course, I know that I'd never be able to take that trip. You'd have to be being some sort of researcher. My family said, you really want to go to Antarctica? Yeah. And hunt meteorites? Yeah, I'd love to. So, even though I don't.
Well, hey, forget the TV show, Jeff. Let's just round up a bunch of individuals that want to go, and we'll just do our own little private expedition. That would be fun. Like, bring camcorders. There we go. We'll just make a YouTube video.
Yeah. Oh, no, we could get back from the expedition and call the network and go, hey, we just did a bonus episode for you guys. Here's the footage. You can just cut it together.
There we go.
We could give it to him as a Christmas present.
Jeff and Steve, thanks very much for being on Cosmic Perspective today and sharing your awesome experiences with us. And I hope you get a chance to go back to some of the places that you've been to that you didn't get a chance to do as much meteorite hunting as you wanted to do, and also get a chance to go to some of those places you've never been to. And again, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thanks for your interest in having us on the show. It's really been a pleasure chatting with you. And can I just mention that if listeners would like to know more about our work, you can visit us at meteoritemen.com. And we are also Meteorite Men on Facebook and Twitter. And we are very engaged in chatting with viewers. And we post regularly to our social media pages. And we love to hear comments from viewers. So send it over.
Jeff and his crew down there in Tucson have done an incredible job on our website as far as chronicling the different places where we've gone and saw a little bit synopsis on that and some of the behind the scenes, and they
Steve,
love them.
Steve, you have a meteorite store now. Is it online also, or just your store?
Yeah, actually, not really. I have a store in historic downtown Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and it's kind of a quirky town. It's a little tourist town in Arkansas. One of only three meteorite stores in the world. The other's in Paris, and the other's in Moscow. Both fine establishments. And but I've kind of gone like a salmon upstream, where everyone wants to go from brick and mortar to online. I'm kind of going, not going from online to brick and mortar, but adding that. And it's been fun.
And this will be an exciting year for me, because my second book was published recently, and so I will have that available. And for people who have enjoyed listening to us tell funny stories and would like to hear more, my book's called Rockstar Adventures of a Meteorite Man, and it's my memoir, and quite a bit of the book relates our adventures making various television shows, not just Meteorite Men. We've made a lot of other TV shows. And an interesting point is that a lot of the photographs in the book were taken by Steve, and that's because it's often just the two of us out in some scary bit of wilderness, and we find a meteorite, and I go, oh, Steve, take a photo. And he's just got a natural talent at photography. And there would be no record of many of these finds and expeditions if it wasn't for Steve being very patient. And it's frustrating when you work with a photographer and they go, well, let me just get, oh, okay, now light's not quite, oh, move this way, no, now you're blinking. I give Steve the camera and he just goes, blam, 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 he'll take 20 photos, and then I'll get back to camp or back home and go, oh, look, there's a really good one. So thanks for that, Steve. And that book, Rockstar, through meteoritemen.com and all our websites. And I hope you find it interesting.
Thanks again for being with us today. It's been a great experience, and love to have you back on again, if you'd like.
Well, thank you. Anytime. Really appreciate your interest. And we will talk again, I
hope. Yes, and happy meteorite hunting.
Thank you. And we wish you clear skies and wonderful astronomy viewing.